This is a movie that's been in theaters for a while now, the best Christmas pageant ever. It's been doing pretty well. It's been in the top 10 grossing films in the country for the last 5 weekends. I haven't gotten to see it yet myself, but it's a story I know pretty well, and I'm sure many of you do as well. It's the book has been out for about more than 50 years. It's one that we read with our kids a lot when they were younger as well. The opening paragraph in the book declares, "The Herdmans were absolutely the worst kids in the history of the world. They lied and stole and smoked cigars, even the girls, and talked dirty and hit little kids and cussed their teachers and took the name of the Lord in vain and set fire to Fred Shoemaker's old broken-down tool house." As the story goes on, though, the Herdmans show up in church one Sunday because they find out that there are snacks there. But when they're there, they manage to bully themselves into taking the lead roles, all of the lead roles in the Christmas pageant that year. And because they've never heard the Christmas story before, they bring a very unique and very unexpected perspective to the proceedings. So young Gladys is angel of the Lord, and when she appears to the shepherd, she shouts, "Hey, a child is born unto you." And they are indeed sore afraid. And Emma Jean, as Mary, wonders how it is that a pregnant woman has to give birth in a stable, and wasn't child welfare notified? Leroy, one of the wise men, decides that much better gift than the frankincense and myrrh is the ham that they got in a food basket. And through it all, a lot of the church ladies and gentlemen are scandalized because it doesn't meet their expectations of a heartwarming story. You know, the young, tender-hearted woman who gives birth to a sweet child in a cozy barn. But really, our scripture texts for this morning are all about challenging expectations. Now, we've been on this journey through the narrative lectionary for several months now, since late August. We moved from creation through the Exodus to the rise and fall of the ancient Jewish kingdoms, and we're at something of a milestone today because this morning marks the last time that the Old Testament reading will be the featured one in our service. Starting next week, last Sunday of Advent, as we are approaching the birth of Jesus, we will be featuring the New Testament as our focus for the rest of our journey. Now, as we come to this last of our primary Old Testament readings this morning from the book of Isaiah, scholars aren't all united on when exactly they think this section of Isaiah was written and what it's addressing. But most scholars, I think, probably do agree that this is directed at the people who are returning from exile in Babylon. So it's been 50 years of hardship and struggle for the Jewish people at the hands of the Babylonians. The captors now have been conquered themselves. The Persian Empire under Cyrus the Great comes along and they take over the Babylonians. And when they do so, they institute a number of new policies. And one of those policies that Cyrus institutes is that he allows the exiles to return home. And many are overjoyed at the news. This is the phrase, woohoo. Is that what you were saying with the kids? Woohoo. We get to go home. They're allowed to go back to the land that the Lord had promised their ancestors. They can live again in Jerusalem. They can worship the God of their ancestors in their own temple. But the harsh reality of life when they get back to Palestine is a shocking corrective to those very high expectations that they have. You see, the land, and especially Jerusalem, was completely devastated when the Babylonians had conquered it, and it had been largely neglected for 50 years. they're allowed to live in that homeland again, but they're doing so still as subjects of a foreign emperor. They're not in charge of their own country. And the resources that they have available to them are pretty meager, far too paltry for the monumental task of rebuilding that they're facing. And now probably the most important work to be done in the minds of many of these people was to rebuild the temple, right? The house of God. And so they painstakingly plan it out all to the last cubit, trying to make it match as closely as they can the magnificent structure that had been built by their ancestor King Solomon. But they know that any building erected by this band of returning exiles in this small province on the edge of the Persian Empire cannot possibly match the glory of that magnificent edifice that had once stood there. And then, before they can even really begin the work of construction, the leaders who return find themselves embroiled in a conflict that threatens to put all of that work on hold indefinitely. Because you see, not everybody had been taken away to Babylon. The common folk had been left there in Palestine around Jerusalem, and they had continued to worship God in their own ways. When the priests and the princes return from exile, then these local folks are eager to worship God again in a beautiful building. But the leaders who come back are not so keen on the help that these folks are offering. Because during their time in exile, those in Babylon had come to realize that the existence of their people was threatened. And in order to meet that threat, what they did is they established a set of very stringent rules that dictated the activities, the behavior of the entire community. And there's these numerous rules and regulations that they've initiated to keep themselves from being polluted by outside influence. Now, the problem was that those who remained in Palestine hadn't lived up to those rules. Frankly, they didn't really know about most of those rules because they didn't have any priests around to tell them. And so they had to find new ways of expressing their devotion to their God in the absence of a temple. And these new worship styles that have been developed in Palestine are suspect by the priests who are returning from Babylon, who've been trained in a traditional style and entrusted with maintaining standards for proper conduct. The result is that instead of a joyful family reunion that a lot of these folks have been expecting, we have two groups who become quite suspicious of one another. Each one claims to be the rightful heir of God's promise. I mean, the exiles, they've retained the orthodox approach to worshiping God in Babylon. The locals, they have retained possession of this land that was promised to their ancestors. And the mistrust and cynicism that these two groups feel towards one another does not lead to much hope that God's people can come together and rebuild Jerusalem. And it's in the midst of that seemingly hopeless situation that the prophet has the audacity to speak the words of hope that we heard read this morning. This is a declaration of good news to those who are suffering. God promises to bind up the brokenhearted, to comfort those who mourn, the poor and oppressed Jewish people, those who had been in exile and those who had remained in the land. All are promised deliverance and justice. The city of Jerusalem and the temple of God will be rebuilt. And the prophet makes it clear that God has not failed these people. Rather, it is the people who have failed to live up to God's promise because of their own false expectations. Both groups are drawing lines to define the true followers of God, but God's vision is one in which all the people are priests. The conflict is one about who's in and who's out, but there's a vision of hope proclaiming a radical message of inclusiveness where everybody has a part to play in God's plan. The priests are obsessed with rebuilding the temple just like it had been before, but the prophet foresees a restoration not only of a building, but of an entire land. And while the conflict is one about technicalities. The vision of hope paints this big picture in which the entire land is a monument to God's magnificence and mercy. The princes worry about how they can afford to do everything that needs to be done. The prophet, however, expects that God will provide what is really necessary, because he sees the true leaders of the community not in the Levites and in the descendants of David, but in the very principles of peace and righteousness. And while the conflict is about what the people are going to do, the vision of hope is a promise that God will act to bring about a full restoration. No doubt, in his own time, the prophet was laughed at by many, probably ignored by even more. His ideas probably sounded like utopian nonsense, scoffed at by anybody who was realistic, right? He's derided as a dreamer, as an idealist. Or perhaps we might call him a visionary. Because with the benefit of hindsight and a long view of history, we can see that the prophet was right. It took generations of struggle, but that temple was rebuilt, it was restored to an even more glorious state than existed in the time of Solomon. That temple also, of course, was destroyed many centuries ago. But the people and the promise have continued to live on. Many empires have risen and fallen, from Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon to Caesar's Rome to Hitler's Third Reich, but these people, God's people, survive. And not only do they survive, their mark is found throughout all of Western civilization. For it's out of this people that God raises up Messiah, the Savior of all humanity, one Jesus of Nazareth. And when we come to our New Testament reading this morning, we find Jesus himself reading these very words from the prophet Isaiah as he begins his public ministry in his own hometown, proclaiming that this is what his ministry is all about. Now, he too is laughed at. He's a dreamer, scorned as an idealist. Eventually, he is put to death because the cynical leaders of his time are afraid of the hope that he is inspiring among the common people of his day. He's not the sort of Messiah that so many people had expected. But although many of his own people fail to recognize him for who he was, hundreds of millions of people are still gathered around the world today to worship him. And I wonder what it is, as all of us gather, what is it that we expect as we too look out and still see a world deeply divided, deeply in conflict? In the best Christmas pageant ever, the other participants in the pageant come to expect the unexpected from the Herdmans. But in the end, the most unexpected thing that happens when the program is actually performed is what happens during the singing of Silent Night, when Imogene, that tough-as-nailed kid, the girl who was smoking cigars in the church restroom, who stole pennies from the Sunday school offering, begins to cry. As the book explains it, Christmas just came over her all at once, like a case of chills and fever, and she started crying. In the final page, we read, "As far as I'm concerned, Mary is always going to look a lot like Imogene Herdman, sort of nervous and bewildered, but ready to clobber anyone who lays a hand on her baby." As we gather here, we come with our own expectations. And like our counterparts in ancient Palestine, we may find that our expectations need to be adjusted. Do we come expecting God to be revealed here just in our own little community of faith? Do we come expecting God to destroy or transform the warmongers, the mega polluters, those other folks that we don't like? Do we come expecting God to bless our faithfulness by showering us with honor, with praise? Do we come expecting our worship to validate our own beliefs, our own way of life? If that's what we come for, we are likely, in the long run, will be deeply disappointed. But if we come expecting a God who will challenge us and enlighten us, if we come expecting that God might be revealed to us in unexpected ways, perhaps even through those whom we think of as our enemies, if we come expecting that our encounter with God can change us to be more like Isaiah, who is called to bring good news to the oppressed, to bind up the brokenhearted, or, of course, like Jesus himself, who declares these words fulfilled in his life and ministry, if these are what we expect, well, then those expectations indeed can be met, and perhaps, with God's help, even exceeded.